Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we're talking about the rise in hate crimes across the country, what to expect in regards to reproductive health rights and rights for transgendered people. But before we can move on, Senator Jeff Sessions has been rewarded for his steadfast support for Donald J. Trump from almost the very beginning of his presidential campaign. Sessions, said to wield great power in Trump's inner circle, provided some of the early fuel to help get Trump off the ground in the presidential race, giving him not only the imprimatur of a Senate endorsement, but also lending his top aides to help give the populist campaign an intellectual boost. Sessions can only be described as a hardcore law and order guy. Perhaps his philosophy can best be summed up by this quote he gave in relationship to the current opioid epidemic. He said, quote, abandonment of the tough on crime policies is directly contributing to the rise in drug use, overdose deaths, and violent crimes in major cities, end quote. Sessions also referred to the entire criminal justice reform effort as a, quote, thumb in the eye to law enforcement and prosecutors. So not surprisingly at all, Sessions has been a major opponent of any changes to mandatory minimum sentence. Here's the senator.
When somebody's facing a 10-year sentence, mandatory minimum, and they know it, and they're not going to go before the judge and talk their way out of it, it makes a difference. To suggest otherwise, I think, is incorrect.
Sessions, of course, states over and over that they are a key crime-fighting tool, but as the Sentencing Project has conclusively demonstrated, the length and severity of a sentence actually do not contribute to a deterrent effect on crime. And as for opioids, as we've reported on this show, it's clear the real culprit is the major pharmaceutical companies and distributors who the government actually blocked law enforcement from seriously investigating. So since Sessions is willing to use his perch on the Senate Judiciary Committee to peddle lies about the efficacy of mass incarceration, it probably won't surprise you to learn he's also the guy who introduced a Blue Lives Matter bill in the United States Senate. Here's Senator Sessions on how he sees local law enforcement.
The front lines of the war to protect American people from crime and murder and death is the local, state, and local law enforcement. Now we are seeing city after city with record murder rates, record surges in crime.
The Thin Blue Line Act, introduced by Sessions in 2015, would make it easier to seek the death penalty for killing or attempting to kill a police officer. And obviously, it flows directly from the comments you just heard from his characterization of the police. And when it comes to civil liberties, well, he's not really any better. Remember Section 215 of the Patriot Act, the section that let the NSA collect and store data about every phone call you ever made? Well, Jeff Sessions was a major supporter of that. He said in an article in the National Review that amending the government's mass collection of people's data would make it harder to quote, stop a terrorist than a tax cheat, which seems supremely ironic now that his boss is a tax cheat. On the First Amendment, Sessions is a little shaky, too. He actually supported a constitutional ban on flag burning, long considered by the courts as protected speech. This has immense implications on a number of levels. First and foremost, as we frequently reported on this show, the FBI is overseeing the proliferation of stingray technology around the country. It seems entirely clear from the evidence that has been released that they are also using stingrays as a backdoor way to avoid getting a judge's authorization to conduct mass surveillance. It isn't difficult to imagine not only this proliferating, but a number of other creative moves by a Sessions Justice Department to push the boundaries of legality in government spying, which certainly makes it worth remembering another fact we've reported on this show, which is the massive surveillance of protest groups done by law enforcement under Obama. Now the political police will be under the control of the hard right, and almost certainly surveillance against political groups will also increase. And when it comes to civil rights, well, Sessions is pretty bad on this one. First, Sessions was actually rejected as a nominee to a federal judgeship in the 80s because of racist statements. As Huffington Post relates, quote, Sessions had called a black attorney boy, suggested that a white civil rights lawyer was a race traitor, joked that he liked the Ku Klux Klan until he found out they smoked weed, and said that that the NAACP and other civil rights groups were un-American organizations trying to force civil rights down the throats of people who were trying to put problems behind them. Sessions also appears to highly dislike the LGBTQ community. He is opposed to gay marriage, opposed to LGBTQ people in the military, and said he sympathized with those who felt uneasy about having a gay Supreme Court justice, calling it a, quote, big concern. Also, of course, Sessions is an immigration hardliner fully backing Trump's mass deportations. He also has a grab bag of other unfortunate views and statements. For instance, regarding climate change, he noted, quote, carbon pollution is CO2, and that's not really a pollutant. That's a plant food, and it doesn't harm anybody, except that it might include temperature increases. You nailed that one, Jeff. So there you have it. Donald Trump's attorney general nominee is a hard right, pro-mass incarceration, pro-militarized policing, anti-gay, climate change denier who doesn't care about the First or Fourth Amendments to the Constitution. State Representative Jason Spencer, Republican of Woodbine, Georgia, has decided to withdraw his bill banning the hijab. Spencer had been attempting to amend the Mask Act, designed to combat the Ku Klux Klan, to make the hijab and niqab de facto illegal. Without right saying it, the law would have created a gray area with the implicit meaning that wearing a hijab while driving on a public road could actually be deemed illegal. Shockingly, Spencer claimed that his bill did not, quote, target any specific group, end quote. Either way, he has decided now that due to the, quote, visceral reaction that resulted from the bill, he will withdraw it. He also said that he was very, quote, mindful of the perception introducing the bill had created. I guess not so mindful that he couldn't figure out that there would be a strong reaction to essentially making it illegal to be a Muslim woman in the state of Georgia. This, of course, is happening in the climate of a drastic uptick in hate crimes overall, and in particular for Muslim women, with many reports of bigots attempting to rip hijabs off women's heads in all sorts of public places. Huffington Post is tracking anti-Muslim hate crimes and has found 289 anti-Muslim acts this year. One that they noted was involving a Victoria State Senate candidate in Kentucky, Dan Johnson, who during his campaign this year posted a meme to his Facebook page calling Islam a, quote, criminal syndicate, and saying the government could indeed ban it. Looks like Georgia isn't the only state with anti-Muslim bigots under the Capitol Dome. And those were today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are very happy to be joined to continue our conversation with Jessica Pielko, who's the Vice President, Law and Courts at Rewire.news, and Olivia Hunt, who's the AmeriCorps Legal Fellow at the Whitman Walker Health Clinic. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Eugene. I'm happy to be here.
Very happy to be here. Thank you.
No, of course, of course. So I think there's quite a bit to discuss in all of this. I mean, I think one of the more – I mean, it's difficult to even know where to start here. You know, with President Trump, the potential President Trump, I think one of the key issues in my mind, Olivia, and I think this is about how laws really work, are, you know, people are – like, say, the Affordable Care Act. Well, okay, you know, they're going to keep some section of the Affordable Care Act. But are there little pieces in laws that can be changed in terms of, you know, definitions and different pieces like that that could heavily affect especially the transgender community that, you know, might not be the big ticket item like keep your kids on health care till 26, but have big impacts on people?
Definitely. So without turning this into an entire civics class on how the different hierarchy of legal authorities works, there are some things that the president affects directly. There are some things that are regulated, you know, chosen by Congress. And then there are things that are put into regulations by the agencies themselves, like Health and Human Services or the State Department. New president coming into the White House can issue whatever executive orders he or she would prefer. That can involve sweeping away any previous executive orders. Mm-hmm. But those usually only deal with the direct administration of particular actions by the government. For instance, with immigration law, during the Obama administration, we saw the president issue the DACA and DAPA orders, the deferred action for parents of Americans and – I'm sorry. I'm drawing a blank on what DACA stands for.
Deferred action programs.
Yes, the deferred action programs. That didn't grant immediate permanent legal status to anybody. That would require a change of a law by Congress. Mm. It just said that we are not going to act against these individuals right now. That's a program that an incoming president can easily wipe away with a different executive order. Mm-hmm. They can't make it more or less enforceable to be in the U.S. without papers. They can just adjust how the government is going to approach enforcing those laws against those people. Mm. By contrast, you have things like the Affordable Care Act, which was put into place by an act of Congress, very elaborate, lengthy statute that has been implemented by the executive agencies, mm-hmm. Health and Human Services most notably. That's also a big thing, and the only thing that can take that away is another act of Congress. The president himself can't do anything about it. But the way the Affordable Care Act's provisions are actually implemented in individual people's lives is controlled by regulations that are kind of in between executive orders and statutes that are put out by Health and Human Services itself. The big one that I'm getting calls about lately, being, you know, working in the healthcare field, is what is this going to mean for my healthcare? Last year, Health and Human Services issued a new non-discrimination guidance regulation called Section 1557, just discussing how they were going to be administering the non-discrimination provision of the Affordable Care Act. What they were saying was that discrimination on the basis of sex, which was barred by the act, does include discrimination against transgender people. Mm-hmm. And what that new guidance said was, transgender people couldn't be barred from receiving health insurance by virtue of being transgender. Being trans itself is not a condition that would preclude getting health insurance. Likewise, trans people couldn't be barred from getting coverage for specific medical procedures just because they're not usually associated with the gender on that person's file. Mm. So for instance, a trans woman might still need to get a prostate exam. A trans man might need to get a mammogram. Those things often get turned down by insurance companies because they say, oh, you have the wrong gender marker for that. Mm. Not under this new Affordable Care Act guidance. Then they also removed complete categorical bars on transition-related medical coverage, which were really common in a lot of states. They would just say, as a rule, we do not cover anything having to do with gender transition. Mm-hmm. Now, here in DC, we're very fortunate that we've had insurance regulations on the books for quite a while that have said that those provisions were unlawful. This was extending it to the entire country. It also included other provisions having to do with record keeping, but that gets into kind of more fiddly bits. And it applied to a lot of health insurance plans, Medicare, Medicaid, anything sold through the healthcare marketplaces, anything sold by a company that also sells through the healthcare marketplaces. It had a pretty wide reach. Mm. And the problem is right now, we don't know what's going to happen to that. The Affordable Care Act itself can only go away by an act of Congress, like I've said about three times now. And right now, we don't know exactly what that's going to look like in the coming year. It's been pledged repeatedly this is a top priority to get rid of the Affordable Care Act, except I think in reality they're going to find it's a little hard to do that without upending a lot of – well, mm-hmm. basically a lot of current law. Mm-hmm. So it's going to take a while to actually make that happen. Right now, nobody that I know of has said anything directly about the Section 1557 guidance, the trans rights.
Yeah.
So we don't know if that's going to be attacked or not, but sure. It could be taken away, in which case
trans
people could be left in like hold.
It's an interesting point for sure. Well, and I wonder, Jessica, I mean, what you think about the same question to some degree, and if you want to comment on any of that. But I mean, the other thing I'm also curious about, you know, what are any potential federal implications, if any, related to all these trap laws that have been out there in the states in terms of the quote unquote pro-life movement? I mean, I know that they feel very empowered by President Trump here. I mean, what are the potential implications for sort of that state level piece on the federal level now that they'll have a friendly president in place?
Oh, well, the implications are enormous. First, let me piggyback on to the 1557 discussion because it really is a very important one. I mean, just this week, for example, a federal court in Minnesota ruled that the state's medical assistance program must cover gender-affirming surgeries. And so what we're seeing is ongoing litigation at the state level in federal courts really pushing the courts to recognize these broad protections. At the same time, 1557 is under attack by several states run by conservative lawmakers who argue that the section impedes on religious liberties. And so regardless of the repeal process and what happens, you know, as the previous guest mentioned, there's a lot in that sausage making. And Section 57 went through, 1557 went through the entire appropriate rulemaking process. So it's not going to be an immediate thing for them to just upend that. What we're seeing, though, are cases already in the pipeline by conservatives to push that challenge along while the repeal process moves forward. So I think it's incumbent upon advocates to sort of be able to walk and chew gum at the same time and realize that, you know, there's going to be a whole bunch of moving pieces to that, because that lawsuit is in Texas and in the Fifth Circuit, and segues into the second part of your question, which is how does this impact reproductive and rights and justice broadly across the country. I think what we're going to see is a significantly renewed attack at the federal level. You know, from 2010 onward, we have seen a whole series of anti-reproductive rights measures get passed in the states. And, you know, you brought up Texas and these trap laws. You know, this summer's decision, which, can you believe it was only a couple months ago we were celebrating an abortion rights victory, but this summer's decision, you know, was a big win. And I think what we're going to see is a pivot at the federal level now to a different set of priorities when it comes to abortion rights. I expect to see a federal 20-week fetal pain ban introduced. I expect to see potentially a federal so-called dismemberment ban. You know, Marsha Blackburn right now has a special investigative committee convened, you know, to the tune of $1.6 million she's trying to stick with taxpayers with, to investigate abortion providers in the wake of the David Dalyden videos. So, you know, Congress and conservatives have been chumming the waters on this, even when it looks like Hillary Clinton was going to be the president, because at that point, you know, for them, the fight was a little different. We have a lot of work to do. You know, in the immediate, we have the ability to gum up some works on a couple of things, but it's going to be a long couple of years.
Well, I think that's a very good point. We're going to take a break, but we're going to come back with more here on all of these issues and more on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are continuing, I guess what you could call our extended conversation here over a couple days about some of the implications about a number of very important issues in the wake of the election of Donald Trump and what potentially could happen in his administration. And we're talking specifically today about some of the issues that are swirling around in regards to LGBTQ rights, women's rights, and so on. Probably will touch a lot more. And we are joined for this conversation by Jessica Pielko, Vice President, Law and Courts at Rewire.News, and Olivia Hunt, who's the AmeriCorps Legal Fellow at Whitman Walker Health Clinic. So I'm just going to keep rolling. And one quick thing that you mentioned at the end there, Jessica, that I wanted to touch up on, the issue of gumming up the works. This is kind of a technical question, but I'm curious about this. Whether it's the Supreme Court or any other sort of judicial issue, now, correct me if I'm wrong here. You only need a simple majority to confirm a judge unless someone tries to block it. Then you got to go through a whole other process. I don't want to get too deep into the terms, where then you got to get 60 votes. So is it possible that Democrats, like, I mean, everyone's saying now, okay, well, the sky is falling, so on and so forth in terms of the courts. But is it possible that it's not going to be that easy to just, like, move through whoever they want in the Senate from the White House in terms of, you know, the judgeships?
That's how it should be in any normal circumstance. But I think one of the lessons that we're quickly learning is that we all exist in the upside down world since this election. So there are a couple different moving pieces. I mean, one, you've seen what the Senate Republicans have done with the Merrick Garland nomination, which is, you know, really pushed to the limit the question of what constitutes advice and consent by the Senate in terms of confirming nominations. So, you know, on the one hand, there's a sort of what I have called a soft filibuster, or even kind of a filibuster by attrition, which is, you know, the process of blocking a nominee by refusing to even engage in the process. There's a lot of debate around whether or not the way that the Senate has behaved is within the bounds of the law. I think it likely is. It's just well outside the bounds of human decency. In terms of how that goes moving forward, you know, Senate Democrats have been really reluctant to use the procedural tools to their full advantage the way that Senate Republicans have. And I think we need to get a little more brass knuckled on that. I mean, there are ways in terms of how nominees get recommended and the manner in which the hearings are conducted. And, you know, again, I don't want to get into the super procedural nitty gritty, but it certainly isn't a full stop block of any of this stuff. But, you know, it is possible that things can, you know, move around a little bit. And the other thing that's important to keep in mind, too, is it depends also on whomever Trump decides to have in his cabinet and as his appointees. To the extent that he draws from sitting senators within the Republican Party, that could very well have an impact on Senate makeup. Not that it would necessarily change hands, but say, for example, Ted Cruz, who his name has been floated now for two different positions, potentially the court, potentially the attorney general. Both give me sweats, but we'll put that aside for a second. Texas, should Ted Cruz get a nod, Texas would require a special election to replace his, to replace him. And so that is a time process. So in the moment there, Democrats, if they have their act together, can seize on something like that. You know, we're grasping at this moment. I mean, it is absolutely not helpful and very dangerous that we have not just all three branches of the federal government in control of the Republican Party, but all three branches of the government more or less controlled by the extreme white nationalist wing of the Republican Party.
Well, Wendy Davis, perhaps get ready to lace up those tennis shoes again here if somehow the Ted Cruz makes it to Supreme Court confirmation. Well, Olivia, you know, one agency that I feel we don't hear too much about, but I think we certainly hear more, but I wonder, you know, the EEOC, what role or how important do you expect that to be over the next, you know, whatever, I guess, 4 years on a lot of these issues, especially with LGBTQ people? I think a lot of people think of EEOC primarily sort of like black, white, race issues, but obviously it deals with all sort of discrimination related things. So do you think that will be a site for struggle, if you will, around a lot of these different issues, a lot of what's happening on, and people should maybe be paying closer attention to that agency?
It's going to be really prominent in the next couple of years, I think, for LGBTQ discrimination issues. There have been a few different angles that people have had for, like, employment discrimination on the basis of being gay or bi or transgender. But the EEOC recently, the past few years, has been kind of the most reliable organization to come down on the side of discrimination against trans people is prohibited. Now, the other organizations that have been enforcing this, we're talking about the Department of Justice. That's going to have a new attorney general. We're going to be seeing new guidance coming in. They're probably going to be backing off on how that is being enforced. The EEOC, on the other hand, has commissioners that are set to serve a specific term. It's a 5-year term, deliberately longer than any given presidential administration. So it's going to be a while before we're even going to see a very different EEOC giving different guidance. In the near future, we're going to be seeing the same EEOC working with the same law, applying it the same way. So I think the EEOC is probably going to be the most reliable avenue for trans people in particular to seek non-discrimination protection in employment.
Well, I think that's an interesting point. And I wonder too, Jessica, if that then will put the – and this has happened before. It certainly happened in the Reagan administration. The EEOC and the crosshairs perhaps of Republicans in Congress and other places in the White House to try to hobble that to the greatest degree possible, I think, or do whatever they can because they view it as, you know, potentially a dangerous – I mean, I know certainly Reagan viewed it as sort of a dangerous piece on racial issues, put our friend Clarence Thomas, who is now the Supreme Court Justice, in there for that reason. So I don't know if you could speak to that as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the current commissioners, Chai Sellblum, Republicans opposed her nomination from the get-go under the Obama presidency. I mean, they absolutely do not like this issue. And I agree that the EEOC, I mean, they were one of the first federal agencies really leading the charge on these issues, and they will continue to be important. Like Health and Human Services with Section 1557, you know, the EEOC guidance that has been used in terms of expanding trans rights in the workplace is also under siege by conservatives. And there's a really troubling case out of the Sixth Circuit that said basically denying employees access to facilities like restrooms that align with their gender identity does not violate Title VII. So we are going to see this as a fight that works its way not only as the administration changes hands, but in the courts alongside of it.
Well, I think that's an interesting point. I didn't know that about Title VII. That's the Civil Rights Act, too, right? That's interesting and important stuff. Okay, well, you know, I wonder as sort of a follow-up question here, too. You know, what I think a lot of people talk sort of abstractly. Well, this is under threat. That's under threat. This is going to happen. That's going to happen. And I wonder, Jessica, I mean, what is the – and let's just assume Obama will not appoint anyone to the Supreme Court in the next 2 months or whatever, and that, who knows, Mike Lee or someone gets on there. I mean, what is the process by which, you know, you get to a point where Roe v. Wade is being overturned by the Supreme Court? I mean, because they can't just randomly take stuff up, right? I mean, it has to be some case that comes to them.
Right. And exactly. And so I think, you know, we have to think of Roe v. Wade being overturned in two ways. One is a direct overturn by the Supreme Court, which, you know, is one avenue. And then another is a Supreme Court decision that would leave Roe and Casey intact, but would create, or would I guess should say, build on the opening under abortion restrictions that already exist. So the first part, in order to get a case sort of up the pipeline, so to speak, that would directly challenge the holding of Roe and Casey, we'd need to have either a federal statute or a state statute that exists in a couple different states that produces differing results. We don't so far have a federal statute, but I mentioned two that I thought would be pretty likely to see in this session, and that is the fetal pain law and a D&E ban. Both of those are pre-viability bans. Both of those should be unconstitutional under Roe, yet both of those have significant latitude in being upheld thanks to a much later decision called Gonzales v. Carhart that basically outlawed the so-called partial birth abortion ban, which is one of the corresponding medical treatments for later term abortions that's under attack now. So we would need a federal statute first, and then we would need a lawsuit, and then it would go up the pipes. That would take a couple of years, you know, maybe 2 years. And in the meantime, though, plenty of time for Trump to put a ninth justice on, because let's be very clear, President Obama will not be able to appoint and have confirmed his justice. This was absolutely something that conservatives stole from him in terms of constitutional power, and we should be upset and very, 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 very angry about that. The second option, though, is conflicting law in the states, and so far the Roberts Court has been reluctant to do that. Both North Dakota and Arkansas had on their books laws that banned abortion up to between 6 and 12 weeks, okay? So, you know, oftentimes folks don't even know they're pregnant at that point. Mm. And both of those cases made their way up to the Eighth Circuit, and in both of those Eighth Circuit opinions, and the Eighth Circuit, for listeners, is the Midwest part of the country, and as conservative, if not more so, than the Fifth Circuit, where Texas is and gets a lot of the attention. And in both of those opinions, the federal appellate court said, we would really love to uphold these laws, but we have Roe standing in our way. So if someone could give us a reason to knock out Roe, we totally would. Mm. And so the flare is up there. And so it's going to be important to see what happens at the state level and where it happens, because what we know is that conservatives have this playbook, and they are very good at passing copycat laws and running them up appellate circuits in the hopes of getting a split decision, because those are the kind that the Supreme Court usually steps in to resolve. So, you know, what I tell people is the threat to Roe is not immediate, as in like the first 90 days, but that it is absolutely out there. You know, the other thing that I think that's important to remember is that conservatives are only one state legislature away from being able to ram through a constitutional amendment at the federal level. They get one more state and they can pass, you know, a constitutional amendment creating personhood at conception. And then, you know, it doesn't matter if Roe's overturned, we will have a federal constitutional amendment that declares life begins at conception.
Mm. Wow. Well, that's big. for some reason, I thought when I asked that question that somehow you would tell me something reassuring. Nevertheless,
I'm so sorry.
No, it's totally okay. You know, Olivia, I wonder, we mentioned Title VII. Will Title IX be something that comes up a lot? I mean, I know especially in terms of a lot of the quote-unquote bathroom bill issues, that well, way I've seen a lot of it come up is like locker rooms and schools, who has the right to use certain bathrooms. And I mean, I don't know if this even falls under Title IX, but I wonder, we namely hear about it about, you know, women in sports, girls in sports. And so will that also play a role in terms of helping define how we look at gender and how it interacts with laws?
Definitely. We're looking actually at two big issues coming up in the relatively near future, both revolving around Title IX. The first one is the Department of Education's Title IX guidance that was really controversial when it was put out late last spring. Title IX guidance for transgender individuals in schools using facilities, restroom facilities, locker room facilities. Speaking as an advocate for the transgender population, I was really happy when I saw it because it was basically laying out everything that I was hoping to see for the people that I serve. Unsurprisingly, there were some people who took issue with that. And this is right on the top of the list of things that the new administration has announced they plan to revoke. Yeah. This is another one of the things that the president actually does get some control over. The other issue that's coming up, and you know, talking with Jessica, was about the Supreme Court. We have a case coming out of Virginia, GG v. Gloucester County, which is about a young trans man in public school in Virginia who, well, he just wants to use the right bathroom. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of interesting if you read all of his commentary that he's been putting out about this, which is basically, I just wanted to pee at some point in high school. Right. Well, this is actually going all the way up. The Supreme Court has agreed to take it up this session. And at this point, nobody who's working in the world of trans advocacy knows exactly what to expect because this is going to be the first major case deciding an issue about trans people in this way that's coming before the court. And that's really going to impact Title IX guidance for the near future because – you know, that's really what's at issue, trans people in schools. And, you know, the question is, will we have a new justice on the court by then? Will it be, an eight-person court that's hearing it? Will we get a 4-4 split? Will we have a new justice? There's really no way to prognosticate on this one, have any clue exactly how this is going to sort out. I just know that everybody who's working in the field is really apprehensive about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I wonder too, Jessica, as someone who both writes and litigates, I assume, on this as well. I mean, is maybe the takeaway here is that as much as people are looking at sort of big sweeping things, that there also is sort of like a death by a thousand cuts kind of situation in terms of all the different things that can happen, that even if maybe you don't move the big ticket item, you know, you still move the agenda, as it were.
Absolutely. And, this Virginia case that the Supreme Court has agreed to take up is a huge one. And among the, you know, various outcomes that were already out there is the idea that if the administration does, you know, revoke the Title IX guidance, which it was in large part the basis of the federal appellate court decisions, which were all in the student's favor. I mean, you know, federal courts have been more or less really good at recognizing that refusing to allow students to use the bathrooms that they need is discrimination. You know, to go back to the lower courts and without that guidance, that, you know, there's just chaos. And I think, you know, that is something that just broadly should trouble people. But the death by a thousand cuts things is very real because we've seen that in reproductive rights. We've seen it in voting rights. We're seeing it in access to healthcare broadly. And so, you know, while the big promises of, you know, repealing the Affordable Care Act on day one of the Trump administration are impossible to carry out, while they are working on those big sweeping promises, and even if they don't get them accomplished, you know, there's still plenty of ways to inflict real harm on the most marginalized communities.
Yes, no, absolutely. You know, I have to say, as a Virginian, Gloucester County, I don't know what you guys are doing over there. You think it's a place that was the center of the slave trade, they'd think a little more carefully about discrimination issues, but maybe that in and of itself speaks to something. Either way, we're going to have to leave it there for today. But thank you so much to Olivia Hunt, Jessica Pielko. We are going to come back with more here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking a little bit about some of the implications of Donald Trump's pick of Jeff Sessions for Attorney General and criminal justice reform in America, and also some of the things around the Philando Castile case undercharging, and perhaps whether we're seeing the dawn of a little bit more accountability around police murders. So joining us to discuss all this and perhaps more is Dr. Philip Stinson, who's an associate professor at the criminal justice program at Bowling Green State University. Dr. Stinson, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, as always, my pleasure.
And so, I think Donald Trump last week deciding to put Jeff Sessions in the seat there for attorney general seemed like a pretty big message to me. I mean, is it fair to say that picking Sessions, that he really is pretty much the anti-criminal justice reform pick?
Well, I think he's got a long track record for that. If we go all the way back to when he was nominated to be a federal judge in 1986, I believe, in the Reagan administration, I think that's absolutely true. And I've been thinking a good bit about that over the last few days. And I'm not too worried about it in terms of criminal justice reform. I'm very worried about it in terms of civil rights matters. But in terms of criminal justice reform, I've been thinking about it. And, you know, a lot of what's been done and what needs to be done in criminal justice reform is really at the state and local level. You know, a lot of crime in this country is at the state level. Most of our prisoners and inmates in jails and prisons are in state and local facilities across the country. And it seems to me that we've made a lot of progress in the last 5 to 10 years, especially when we look at evidence-based practices in the criminal justice system, when we look at sentencing reform, when we look at community-based corrections, and we really start to think about dealing with offenders more on a public health model than as we have historically dealt with them in terms of figuring out what to do with offenders. So we really want to be thinking about what works in terms of what reduces recidivism. And a lot of that's at the local level. The area that I think is the big – I actually think there are two areas that we really need criminal justice reform in this country. The first would be the whole area of cash bail, because if you look at the people who are locked up in our jails across the country, a lot of them are pretrial detainees, and they're there solely because they couldn't raise the cash bail. And frankly, the bail was set too high. So I think we need to take a close look at cash bail. The other thing that concerns me, and this has been something that's been bothering me for a while, is prosecutorial misconduct. And the problem there is that prosecutors are very rarely held accountable, either in the federal courts or in the state courts. They get to do what they want to do. They certainly have qualified immunity in terms of suing prosecutors, but there's a lot of prosecutorial misconduct. And one of the big areas in that regard is in terms of withholding evidence that tends to be exculpatory. In other words, evidence that would tend to favor the defendant under a U.S. Supreme Court case from years ago called Brady versus Maryland has to be disclosed to the defense. And I think in many places across the country, not everywhere, but in many places, prosecutors are somewhat remiss in their Brady obligations at times.
Well, and I mean, what's the solution there in prosecutorial misconduct? I mean, is it just more sanctions by judges? I mean, is there some sort of legal change? I mean, what does it take to sort of get reform in the case of these cases?
Well, in theory, prosecutors are there to do justice. In practice, though, prosecutors are there to win. And in many cases, prosecutors will win at all costs. So I think that the only way that you change that culture in terms of winning at all costs, winning at any cost, is holding prosecutors accountable, prosecutors being charged with criminal contempt of court. Now, that would require that in every single case, the judge affirmatively issue an order requiring them to comply with their Brady obligations, which really seems kind of absurd. But that's really what apparently it would have to take in order to have the teeth where prosecutors could actually be charged with, among other things, criminal contempt of court. And that just doesn't happen. Defense attorneys are held accountable in many, many ways in terms of disciplinary matters, in terms of criminal matters. But prosecutors do what they want to do. It's in my view, many prosecutors are acting in renegade ways. They just do what they want to do, and they're above accountability.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know what we can do to change it. Other than that, having some teeth in some criminal sanctions, a few prosecutors spending some time in jail, that might help get the message across.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that it certainly would. That would be something that we had not really seen much of. And I wonder, you know, because it's, and just to swing back quickly to the AG piece, I just wonder also, because I tend to agree with you in terms of a lot of the substance being at the local and state level. I think that's sort of one of the things the movement for Black Lives activism is kind of revealed. But that being the case, I was thinking that really the most dangerous place in terms of Sessions as an AG is really kind of the bully pulpit piece. I mean, the same way I feel like Comey, for instance, in the FBI has been sort of pushing back on a number of different issues and using that sort of credibility that, you know, whether it's the amicus curiae briefs, whether it's press conferences, whatever, like that's kind of the place where the AG is the most dangerous. Maybe in this case is when, you know, something's disputed on the local or state level and it's going back and forth and they use that sort of imprimatur to maybe try to put a thumb on the scale. So I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. And I think I really hadn't put much thought into this aspect, but if you go back and look at some of the more contentious things that Sessions has said over his course of his career, in some ways, they're very Trump-esque. He says things that are really out there at times, and maybe it's a match made in heaven with the two of them. I don't know.
Well, certainly Donald Trump may think that since he's been with him from the first place. And, you know, one of the things just on an issue that I wanted to sort of get some clarification on here and make sure what I've been saying is correct, one of the big issues that's coming up around Sessions is this issue of mandatory minimums and whether he's for it or against it. But beyond what he's for, I mean, it seems that now the general trend is that these mandatory minimums were not super effective in actually reducing crime. And I keep hearing them being brought up like, oh, we need mandatory minimums again by people who are, you know, ringing the alarm bells about the crime rate or whatever. But I mean, is there any like fact-based research to prove that these are making any sort of positive influence, if you could even call it that?
No, not that I'm aware of. I don't think so. You know, one of the things with sentencing reform in the federal system is there certainly is a race component to it. If you look back over the years with the disparity in sentencing crack cocaine versus powder cocaine, and there have been efforts in recent years, certainly when Eric Holder was Attorney General, to rectify a lot of that, and the president is still dealing with that. But I do think there are some race issues here. You know, we have a whole generation of black men who were, you know, locked up for long periods of time in federal prisons on crack charges. And it all goes all the way back to Len Bias, you know, the basketball player at the University of Maryland many, many years ago when he passed away. You know, it was just sort of almost a, you know, crime control rhetoric to get us where we got. But, you know, I think it was a mistake. And I do think there is a race component. And I think that's what makes Sessions particularly scary because of his long track record saying incendiary things in terms of, you know, relations with African Americans, with black people.
Absolutely. Well, you know, and let me ask you this too, just sort of slightly shifting gears here. You know, looking at the hung jury in the Ray Tensing case and the killing of Samuel DuBose, you know, one other issue that I feel like it's gotten some interest, but it hasn't gotten a ton, is this issue of jury selection. I mean, I'm hesitant to draw too much from this. I mean, I think obviously people of any race can rule in a way that is justice related. But that being said, you know, you're looking at a case like this, you have 10 white people, you have 2 black people. And like, what is a jury of your peers in a case that so heavily hangs on, well, was this guy at all justified or not to do what he did? I mean, if you never experienced driving while black or being harassed by the police because of your race, I mean, when it's such an outsized sort of racial imbalance there, I mean, does that raise some questions about the fairness of juries in situations like this?
Yeah, if we were to look at the next biggest problem with prosecutorial misconduct, once we get past what we discussed a few minutes ago, I think it's in the whole area of using peremptory strikes to strike potential jurors because of their race, excusing black people, and then coming up with another reason. And there's a case, it's called Batson versus Kentucky, a Supreme Court case from the 1980s. You cannot exclude a juror solely based on race. And I think it happens in courtrooms across the country on a regular basis across the United States, where prosecutors are absolutely excluding people of color from juries. So I'm not sure if that's the problem there with the Tensing case or not. I think there are some other issues going on here. You know, we've had, if we go back at the time that I've been researching crime by police officers, back to the beginning of 2005, by my count, as of today, 78 sworn state or local law enforcement officers across the country have been charged with murder or manslaughter resulting from an on-duty shooting where the officer shot and killed somebody. And of those, and that includes the most recent one from Minnesota last week. And if we look at those 78, to date, only 27 have resulted in a conviction, 14 of them by jury trial, 13 by guilty plea. And by my count, only one officer is actually serving time on a murder conviction. Only one out of those 78. One officer convicted of murder. It's generally that they're convicted of a lesser offense. And I think that one of the problems, and you've alluded to it earlier, is the whole issue of, do we have the right charges? Are prosecutors bringing the right charges in these cases?
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's a good point. And also that sort of in raising the Philando Castile case out there in Minnesota. I mean, a lot of people saying this officer Yanez being charged with second degree manslaughter, that that was like a big undercharge. I mean, just on the basis of the way the prosecutor laid out his case. I mean, I wonder what you think about that.
I actually think it's the other way around. I think in most of these cases, when we go back and look at them, Tensing included, the University of Cincinnati police officer who recently his trial ended in a hung jury. I think that the tendency of prosecutors in these cases is to overcharge, and sometimes it's for political reasons. And, you know, I tell my undergraduate students, you know, you got to be careful as a prosecutor. If you ever work as a prosecutor, you got to be able to prove the elements of each crime. And if they don't stop and think about the basic elements of the crime and they get caught up in the hysteria, I think they overcharge. And I think that's one of the reasons why these cases have resulted in officers not being convicted or hung juries and you end up with mistrials, because I'm not so sure that these cases really are premeditated murder cases. So in Minnesota, manslaughter in the second degree is punishable by not more than 10 years in prison or payment of a fine of $20,000 or both. And there the statute requires that a person have culpable negligence where they create an unreasonable risk and consciously take chances of causing death or great bodily harm to another. And quite honestly, I think that's probably the appropriate charge.
Interesting. Well, that's certainly I think in some cases that's what we've seen is juries have not been looking to convict on heavier charges. I mean, it just to me raises the whole issue. I don't know, because it's not premeditated, but I think, and I don't know, maybe this is obviously not at all related to the police, but certainly the case of it. I think what's really getting people is the 10 years when the story that they tell and that allegedly is caught on video that I guess they'll show on trial is that the guy didn't really, you know, do much of anything, comply with all the orders and still, for reasons that are somewhat unknown, was just gunned down. It's sort of like, how is it not murder? But I hear you, and certainly in the way – but go ahead.
The videos have made a difference, and one of the things that the videos have done is – and I've talked to some police chiefs across the country from big cities, and two things have caught their attention. One is that officers are acting in these shootings, acting in ways that are completely inconsistent with their law enforcement training, to the level that it really shocks, you know, the police chiefs and the agencies that they work at. And then the second thing is that we see that on many cases, officers statements that are given, the reports that they write after these incidents are inconsistent with the video evidence. So I'm not going to suggest necessarily that they were lying, but in the past, the police have solely owned the narrative in these cases. The version of the story is told is based on the facts as they tell it. And as I've said before, a dead man can't talk. And now we have another version of the story. The video evidence doesn't seem to result in a slam dunk conviction. If anything, some of these cases, the videos have actually seemingly confused the juries and not resulted in convictions. Jurors tend to want to give officers in these cases the benefit of the doubt. They don't want to believe that a police officer could be guilty of murder. They don't want to believe that a police officer is a murderer, and they just have trouble going there.
Well, I mean, I think that's an interesting point. I mean, it seems like one of the big issues may not be legality. I mean, it may be narrative based. I think that obviously the police spend quite a bit of time, you know, sort of building up a certain image of themselves, which obviously is helping them. And I think in some of these trials, and I mean, obviously one of the issues that people do raise a lot though is the legal bar for killing someone too low in terms of, you know, what's considered reasonable and what's considered unreasonable. I've had some people on the show tell me they didn't think it really mattered at all. I've had other people say that they thought the all important thing was that the Supreme Court controlling decision just made it so easy to sort of get off by just saying, well, you felt threatened. So I wonder where you fall on that one.
Well, it's not a subjective position, though. It's not whether the, you know, if the officer felt that way, but it was, but, you know, it's a, what a reasonable police officer would do. So under the relevant case law, the Supreme Court case law, if an officer has a reasonable apprehension of an imminent threat of serious bodily injury or death being imposed against the officer or someone else, then the officer is legally justified in using deadly force. The problem with that standard is you can have an officer who's found to be legally justified under that standard, and yet the investigators and the prosecutors who are making that determination will also tell you that perhaps the shooting was completely unnecessary and inappropriate, and yet it's legally justified. And that seems to be the problem. And I think that's where we got to figure out how to fix that kind of a problem where I think the standard is correct, but I think we've got to close these loopholes because we should not have people being killed when it's unnecessary. I mean, that's just an absurd thing.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I mean, it's one of those things where it just really makes you wonder if perhaps the Supreme Court, I don't know who that's going to be, could shed some light here by taking up, somehow, some of these cases somewhere to talk more about it. Because I think that's also a big issue is that we have a lot of controversy around these cases, but they're sort of just like set piece, one-off cases. Nothing ever really gets resolved. So we talk a lot about it. But then at the end of the day, at least from the point of view of the legal process, other people have told me they think Congress should pass some laws to try to define standards better in terms of what's allowed and what's not allowed.
I'm just not sure how you can do that at a federal level. Mm-hmm. I'm just not sure how that would work.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's tricky. And I think that's part of the pieces too, is that policing is so parcelized out. It creates all these other sort of, you know, realities behind it, I guess, that it may be. So moving forward, I guess, bottom line, you're feeling not terribly discouraged by the pick of Jeff Sessions. You think that many things could still happen, and it's on the state and local level where that action is probably going to be most meaningful.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing to keep in mind with the police shootings, if we go back to that just for a second, mm-hmm. keep in mind that nobody was paying attention to those cases until Michael Brown was killed in Ferguson, Missouri in August of 2014. Now people of all walks of life are paying attention. And I think it's going to take some time for this to work out. And we're not seeing more officers necessarily getting charged each year. We're still seeing that about 1,000 times a year an on-duty police officer shoots and kills somebody in the United States. And that's a problem. But I think we're on the right track because we're paying attention, and that's a good start.
Mm-hmm, fantastic. Well, that was Dr. Philip Stinson, who is an associate professor at Bowling Green State University in the Criminal Justice Program, and that is going to do it for our show here today. You were listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. See you next time.
By any means necessary.